Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. As we've gone through this series, our panellists have noted various difficult issues that need to be tackled as we attempt to restrict global warming to 1.5 degrees C, as proposed by the 2018 IPCC report. Amongst these were the problem of getting countries, companies, and individuals to act collaboratively, the challenge of delivering sustainable energy, and working out the other greener policies that our politicians have yet to enact. But thinking about these things has led me to reflect on whether a broader, more fundamental change to our economic and political system is needed. That system is based on competitive markets. But can such markets be used to promote the collaborative action we need? And markets are forward-looking. But climate change is partly historical. Should industrial nations have to pay more for their massive past contributions to climate change? These questions seem to point up a serious tension. Is it possible for us to be both green and capitalist? With me to discuss this today are Thomas Hale, Associate Professor in Public Policy at the Blavatnik School of Government, Charmaine Love, Entrepreneur in Residence at the Scholl Centre for Social Entrepreneurship at our Said Business School, and joining us by Skype, Ben Caldicott, Associate Professor at the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment, and founding director of the Oxford Sustainable Finance Programme. Hello, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, great to be here.
Hello, Peter.
Ben, can we come to you first to frame this debate? Who first started to ask these questions about whether green policy is possible within our current economic and political system?
Gosh, well, that's a good question. A good way to kick off. I think this has been part and parcel of the environmental movement from the very beginning, really. Is the current economic system, is capitalism compatible with sustainability with these environmental objectives, whether it's climate change or biodiversity? So it's been intertwined with the evolution of the environmental movement.
And how do you think thoughts about these have evolved over time?
Well, I think the environmental movement and people researching and studying the environment have over the last few decades been encouraged to kind of follow the money. So a lot of the thinking, a lot of the policy responses, a lot of the proposed solutions kind of happened in the absence of a consideration of economics and finance. The conservation community very focused on habitats and nature and species conservation. And so there's a sort of a next generation of environmentalists, I suppose, and it's kind of accelerated over the last 10 to 15 years that have really started to look at economics and finance and trying to follow the money, because obviously the money
right.
Drives change in the system, and so understanding that and how we shape that to make sure it's aligned with these environmental objectives is very important.
So has that been mainly driven by a perception that relying on people's goodwill just isn't going to do it?
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. So conservation movements in the 60s, 70s, 80s, saying many of the same things, of course, actually, that we're saying now, and many people are saying now, but just weren't getting the cut through. And so, for example, one of the things that happened at the beginning of this decade was going, actually, we've not had a conversation with major institutional investors. We haven't had a conversation with central banks and financial regulators about our capital is flowing into things that are harming the environment and should be channeled to things that can solve these problems. Let's really understand those systems and then engage and try and influence them. So that's a relatively new phenomenon.
But this way might not work. I mean, actually, it might be that a fundamental change of view is required, and it's a failure on the part of the human race, or the economic part of the human race, that it's not responded to things other than economic incentives.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. To what extent? It's all very well, of course, getting the Bank of England to do various things, and that's been quite successful in a short period of time, and we can talk more about that over this discussion. But is it enough? and particularly given the fact that we haven't made enough progress over the last 30, 40, 50 years, and consequently, we really have to up the pace of action to make sure that we don't breach these ecological thresholds. In the case where we haven't breached them already, I feel we've breached many of them already. So there is that sense of urgency.
So is there a general optimism? Do you think that this will work, or is it the only thing that will work if anything does?
Well, I would subscribe to both those views. I think there is optimism about how these levers can deliver change, and lots of evidence around that. And I can't see other models delivering the innovation, the creativity, the scale that's required to achieve the changes that we need to see. But that's not to say that we're making the progress that we need to make at the pace we need to make it, clearly.
But if anything's going to work, this is going to be it. So that's where we need to focus, would be your view, is it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, global wealth is, according to UBS, something like $240 trillion. The value of global stock and bond markets is something like $150 to $170 trillion. You know, we need to get those deep wells of capital to move to shape economic systems to become aligned with sustainability. And I don't know how else we do it, or where else the money is going to come from, or how else it's going to be motivated. Obviously, there's a lot of detail that we need to discuss. How do you remunerate these things efficiently? What's the role of government? You know, this idea that all of this can just happen without the government, of course, is fantasy. So it is a true public-private partnership, and that partnership will differ based on where we are in the world and also what kind of solutions we're trying to realise.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Shah?
Yeah, if that's okay, I'd love to come in. And hi, Ben. I don't think we've actually connected in person, but it's great to be on this line with you. I just want to throw in a point, because I think, there's so much of what Ben said that I'd like to respond to. But in particular, if we're talking about trillions, like numbers that have lots and lots of zeros behind them, one of the really interesting things we've been trying to track over the last couple of years is the amount of cash equivalents and short-term investments that are sitting on publicly traded company balance sheets. And it's pretty extraordinary, actually. The last time we did the bull of that number, it was $21 trillion. And again, it's not a perfect proxy for sort of the liquidity, but what it does represent is a huge amount of capital that is sitting on, again, publicly traded company balance sheets. So we know that's conservative because it's not taking into account privately held businesses. And one of the things that's really interesting to think about is, you know, why are companies holding that much capital? And we know that there's a war chesting strategy that's sort of in play right now, where people are knowing there's a lot of change happening. So they are holding capital in order to be able to do dividend top ups or share buybacks. And I think it's a really interesting question to ask of whether or not that's the right use of that capital when we are seeing the sort of extreme levels of transition that are needed. And we can talk about it in relation to climate and to the growing levels of inequality. But ultimately, if we are going to harness the power of business to be a force for good, then those businesses need to be investing in what is necessary from a transition perspective.
It's a great point. And how do we create the incentives that allow businesses to invest, whether it's in China or the UK or sub-Saharan Africa? And that gets into questions of governments, it gets into questions of contracts and price signals and how we create these. And some of them exist already. Sometimes they don't exist at all, and we need governments to create them through regulation. And that is, you know, we've made some progress on climate and carbon in particular, but clearly not enough. We're really at the very, very beginning of trying to create the price signal for restoring nature, creating ecosystem services, and protecting natural capital. And we just don't have the time.
Right.
These mechanisms need to be operating at a global scale.
Indeed. And global cooperation is a difficult thing to achieve, even given a long time scale. Tom, you've written a lot about global cooperation. Can you take us through some examples of how countries have been approaching this in different ways?
Yeah, no, I think going back to your first question, Peter, about the origins of this debate, there's actually a really important international dimension that's important for understanding the background and context for this question. So When environmentalism came into its modern moment in the late 60s, early 70s, there was, if you want, a Malthusian character to it. There was a very influential report internationally called The Limits for Growth, put out by the Club for Rome, which is basically saying we can't have as much economic growth if we want to retain a planet we want to live on. And that message was difficult for some stakeholders in the global north, of course, but it was particularly difficult for those countries in the global south, which were at that time freeing themselves from colonialism, coming into national development plans, and thinking, how are we going to build a country for our people and lift them into a standard of living that would actually do them justice? And so the synthesis that was created in the 80s was this idea of sustainable development, which meant you could have your cake and you could eat it too. There's a lot of cakeism in this kind of thing. And that was great. And it's true, of course. We need to have a triple bottom line when you think about the environmental consequences, the economic ones, and the social ones, and to think about policies and business models that get us progress on all three of those things. But I think the crisis that we're in now is in some ways a failure of that cakeism to deal with some of the hard questions that come up. So it can't be that all of those things are perfectly aligned with each other all the time. There are going to have to be transitions, and transitions have winners and losers. And one of the difficulties is that the potential losers from a lot of those crises have for a long time withheld progress on getting the right balance between those three factors of social, environmental, and economic growth.
And aren't you meaning countries or other agents?
I mean countries, I mean companies, I mean individuals. So all of us who have benefited from high levels of carbon exploitation, for example, have some share in this. And some companies who are particularly concentrated interest in that have done a very good job of trying to defend those concentrated interests. And the politics we see now are an interesting response to that, and are suggesting that we're going to see a much more combative space around these questions politically going forward. So I think the kind of cakeism is no longer going to be enough to cut it.
Right. And do you have an alternative in mind?
So I think that the distributional politics of how this will play out will be a bit messy. We're always seeing those messes, and there will be things that Ben has worked on very closely, stranded assets that are left behind, and there will be people who are negatively impacted by these kinds of transitions. And to deal with the politics of that, we need to think a lot about how to create a future that everyone can see a bright future in. And so if you're a coal worker in West Virginia, or if you're a Bangladeshi farmer worried about flooding, you're going to need to see decarbonization and climate change proceeding in a way that's going to give you a space to survive in. And that's a difficult thing we need to work out. So I think we need to focus a lot more on compensation, and how we make sure the losers from these transitions are going to be brought in a way that's going to make them not obstructionist, but happy with the solution.
And how far is the route forward going to involve cooperative action between different governments? And how much, on the other hand, might it involve simply tweaking the incentives within the economic system so that things just naturally play out?
So I think cooperation between governments will be critical. What we've had in the past has been a kind of, if you want, a global deal model, where all the limit of our international ambition has been limited by the weakest link, because we've insisted that we have an approach that allows every country to agree to a global deal. The Paris Agreement in 2015 helped to shift that paradigm to what I call a catalytic system, because it's trying to say not that we have to negotiate a global deal, but rather every country, every actor should put forward their own commitment. We ratchet those up over time toward this ultimate goal we all want to get to. Within that context, we're going to need a lot more detailed cooperation, I think, going forward around certain sectors, around different kinds of tangible points of opportunity to work together on. But getting beyond that sort of collective action problem was a really important breakthrough that gives us a bit of hope going forward.
Do you think the action that's been happening in the wake of Paris is such as to give grounds for optimism that things will happen quickly enough?
I think we have a few areas where things are happening at a reasonable pace. I think we have a lot of areas where we need to make a lot of progress much faster as of yesterday. And sadly, I think the balance is more on the latter than on the former across many areas. Some that are going well, electric vehicles, renewable energy, that's great. Things that are going more slowly, heavy industry, international aviation or shipping, the land use sector, these are places where we've got some ambitious targets in some cases, but implementation is tough because it takes time, it takes the right alignment of governance and incentives. And here's where I think actually the business community has a big role to play in helping us get a bit further than we are on those kinds of issues, and especially sectoral collaboration as a way to overcome some of the short-termism and some of the individual competition dynamics that hold us back from reaching a bit further.
Sure.
I first just have to acknowledge I love the have your cake. Having your cake and eating it too is not going to cut it anymore. Like, you know, but I'm bummed. And it's interesting. If I can riff on that for just a minute, because we open the elective that we run in the business school on the circular economy. One of the kind of questions we kind of kick off with is sustainable growth a paradox? And have sort of a picture of an Escher painting, you know, with thing drawing with people going off in different directions. And it's an interesting way to think about it, because actually, if we're talking about sustainable growth, but that form of growth is dependent or fueled on finite resources, it's a paradox. You actually can't put those words sustainable and finite in the same sentence together, because they're contradictory. So, you know, what we really know we need to do is look at what are the different business models that are sort of attacking that paradox of thinking about ways of growing. And, you know, we have to put, I think, a flag there to talk about what does growth actually mean in the 21st century. But growing in such a way that is no longer dependent nor fueled on these finite resources. And so we spend a lot of time in the circular economy course looking at those businesses that are really trying to try different things out from a business model perspective, whether it's not they're looking at innovations in how they can deliver their product as a service, whether it's using sharing platforms like we're seeing in, for example, the car industry. So we know that, you know, car sharing is a huge area of potential growth. And so we're spending a lot of time really trying to look at that. I look at that paradox and see what are the different models that can help overcome some of that those issues that remain between how we think about sustainable growth if, you know, again, we're looking at finite resources. I also want to just quickly pick up on the point around the cooperation amongst countries, because I think it's really interesting. And what I'm picking up a lot now in the space is that there's an interest in creating greater levels of collaboration between different movement organizations. And in fact, we've got sort of a little project we've been running for the last little while called A Movement of Movements. And what it's trying to do is look at, there's a range of different movement organizations that are really trying to figure out how to mobilize people in order to galvanize and create real systemic change. But a lot of these different movements are operating with a particular narrative in mind and haven't necessarily found effective means to collaborate in the past. And so what we've been trying to do is figure out if there is a way to mobilize or create collaboration platforms where we can get these different movement organizations, which all are trying to sort of generally get in the same direction of mainstreaming a different way of thinking about our economic system, or a different way of thinking about how we can work together on the collective action that's needed to address the climate emergency that we're in. But what we need to do is think about comparative advantage the same way I do a lot in looking at how countries collaborate with one another. So what are the different assets? What are the theories of change? What are the networks and the communities of stakeholders that these different movements work with? And how can we create a very clear pathway for them to collaborate with one another, knowing that to solve the big systemic challenges, we really do need to find ways for organizations to come together much more effectively.
Right. I mean, I can see that's a great thing. Is it going to actually impact the big industries that we need to change anything like quickly enough? I mean, suppose you're running an air freight company or shipping, and those two things that Tom mentioned. You've got all these tax benefits when it comes to fuel. You don't want to change. You're doing very nicely. What is going to force you to act? This collaboration between movements is just going to be water off a duck's back, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know if I would call it water off the duck's back. I mean, to be clear, I think when we're talking about movements, we're talking about organizations that are not necessarily businesses themselves. So I think defining what we mean. Sure. So I probably wouldn't speak to necessarily the collaboration that's happening across businesses, although I could, because I think one of the things that's interesting is to see more businesses looking at pre-competitive collaboration. So this idea that actually, in order to change a system or to change the rules of the games, businesses that otherwise would be competitive in the market come together and kind of work as a collective in order to sort of really push for changes so that the playing field is different. So it's, again, this idea that you would find ways to collaborate in order to change the conditions of the market. And then on the other side of that, maybe other forms of competition arise. But I think it's really interesting to see businesses that are coming together to try and understand how they can create a higher level of operating, a higher level platform where they can operate at a market level.
But isn't a lot of the basis on which businesses work, I mean, particularly in the sectors I've just mentioned, a lot of the framework is that it is set by international agreements on taxation of fuel and so forth, right? Now, businesses coming together, however well-intentioned, are not going to be able to change that without government action, are they?
No, I agree. I think government action is often a necessary condition. And the reason why you see some businesses taking a leading role in some cases is precisely to preempt government action. If they're able to do it better, more quickly through their own efforts, they'll forestall some regulation that might come as a surprise to them later on, or that might be less conducive to their future business interests. So I would say the smart businesses think about what might be coming down the pipeline and get ready in advance, and you see them making these kind of pre-competitive moves as a way to respond in advance of regulation. But if the threat of regulation isn't there, it's harder to see why people would move.
Right. So the movements of movements that Shah was talking about can change the political reality or what's coming down the line politically, and the wise businesses will see that coming and adapt in advance.
Yes, or else they might risk becoming what Ben calls stranded assets.
Mm. Right. I'd like to go to Ben in a moment about that, but for Shah, you want to comment?
Oh, well, it's just interesting to me as well, because in part of our research when we were looking at balance sheets, the other thing we looked at was how much the Fortune 500 list changes over time. So if you look at the Fortune 500 list today, and then you look back 50 years ago, there's only 13% of those companies that are still on that list. So in other words, like, you kind of have to innovate and you have to keep up on the trends that are happening. Otherwise, you're going to fall behind. Now, it's important to know there are still 500 companies on the Fortune 500 list. So it's those companies that have been able to sort of pick up what's happening. There's a great quote by Wayne Gretzky, which says, you know, I don't skate to where the puck is, I skate to where the puck is going. And I think that's a really relevant thing that businesses should be thinking about. Don't think about what's happening today. Think about what's going to be happening tomorrow. And it's those businesses that are already heading in that direction that are going to be in the equivalent of that 13% rather than being displaced.
Right. Yes, that's very interesting. And humans are notoriously prone, if something has been more or less constant for 20 or 30 years, they tend to assume it's always been like that. Actually, from a longer time scale, businesses fail. And your business is likely to fail unless you don't change it.
Yeah. And I think I make sure Ben gets a chance to come in. But I would like to at some point respond to the point about businesses that are stepping ahead of regulation, because that is sort of in many ways the premise of the B Corp movement.
Right. But I think that's going to be related to the stranded assets issue too, isn't it? Ben, can you tell us about stranded assets, what they are and why they matter?
Sure, absolutely. Well, essentially, it sort of links back to Schumpeter and this idea of creative destruction, and the fact that in market economies, value is created as economies change and value is destroyed. And so the stranded assets side of that equation, this equation is when value is lost. And we see in economic transformation over time that this does tend to happen in phases. So there's been a lot of research looking at this economic history, where in every 50 to 60 years thereabouts, so these big transformations that result in lots of stranded assets.
And what's an example of a stranded
brands, companies?
Right.
Well, so for example, just going back to the Industrial Revolution, the transition in the United Kingdom from canals to railways resulted in lots of value being destroyed. People had invested in canals and canal-related infrastructure and economic systems were dependent on canals, and then the railways emerged and that creates a lot of value. And similarly, from transitions from sail ships to steamships and from horses and carriages to automobiles and so on and so forth. I think one of the interesting things, though, the reason this is particularly interesting for this conversation, is that the drivers of creative destruction, the drivers of asset stranding, are changing, and they're increasingly related to the environment directly or indirectly, both in terms of physical environmental impacts from climate change, but also from some of the regulatory developments that we've been talking about, new policies that are being introduced, but also the technological change that's happening partly as a result of policy. as well as the social norms that are changing and can change very quickly, and related things like litigation and liability. And these are all happening at the moment and are reshaping different sectors of the global economy, some of which have been mentioned already, power generation, the automobile industry, for example, electric vehicles, and so on. But I think just coming back, linking this back to the conversation that Tom kicked off about cooperation and the international process. But before the big Copenhagen climate change negotiations in 2009, which didn't end well, there wasn't a global deal reached then. Everyone was basically saying, the tackling climate change, all of this stuff, they're just going to be lots of winners. There'll be no, it's all going to be wonderful. There are going to be no losers. This economic transformation isn't going to result in asset stranding and possibly unemployment and stranded communities and workers and so on. And that is incredibly unrealistic. And it was only after Copenhagen that work on this really began. And it's really important because you need to know who's going to be a loser. You need to know when assets are going to be stranded so that you can mitigate the effects of those. And that's really important for building consensus and support for the transition. It also helps you avoid them as well, avoiding stranded assets in the future.
Can I just get clear on why stranded assets are so important? So, I mean, you gave the example of canals giving way to railways. Now, that meant a lot of people had invested in canals and then suddenly those assets that they'd invested so much in ceased to be worth very much. Is that the basic point about stranded assets?
That is the point.
Right.
The thing that is different, though, is the scale of the incumbent industries that are going to be affected and are being affected by the transition. And if you just look at climate change,
right,
for example, the fossil fuel industries, 25%. Of dividend payments in the UK come from two oil and gas companies, BP and Shell.
Yeah.
Very significant proportion of the FTSE 100 comes from fossil fuel companies. So we're exposed to this through our banking system, through our stock markets, through our bond markets, every bit of the financial system. And that's what makes central bankers like Mark Carney and others concerned about this.
Right.
Because there could be a sudden revaluation and that could have implications for financial stability and economic growth and society more broadly.
Indeed, but one could see that working out in various ways. I mean, one you've already mentioned is that you might think that those who've invested in the stranded assets ought to be compensated. But another view might be, at this stage in history, people should be looking ahead and seeing that the fossil fuel industry is going to end up with a load of stranded assets. So you better put your money somewhere else. It's not sensible to continue to invest in that in a big way.
Absolutely. So, you should be... The risks are plain. They've been clear for a very long time. We've known about the science for a very long time. There is no excuse to keep deploying capital into things that are incompatible with these bigger societal objectives.
Right.
And if you continue to do so, there's no reason why you should be compensated.
Quite.
But
at the same time, that gives an incentive to those who are in those areas to resist any change, right?
Well, exactly. And this is where you get into the political economy of it and the politics and what you need to do to achieve change quickly. And it might be the case that you do need to compensate key asset owners, key bits of the society, to get them on board so the transition can happen more quickly. And then the question is, well, how do you do that efficiently and quickly enough? And there are different mechanisms that could be used to do that. Examples of this happening in the past, for example, with the slave trade, and the UK government compensating slave owners to accelerate the transition away from that pernicious trade. Could something like that happen for climate change and the fossil fuel industry? Possibly in pockets where it's politically necessary, maybe. These are massive industries, massive global industries. But I'm sure Tom is going to have some thoughts about how we do that.
He does indeed.
No, I'm glad you raised the slavery example because I think it is an all too telling example for this transition we're facing now. Slavery was abolished across the British Empire because of moral objections driven by religious communities in most part. But the people who had been driving the slave trade benefited from this by a huge payout from the taxpayer. I think, if I'm not mistaken, some researchers at UCL found something like 12% of the national budget in one year in the 1840s was spent on payments to colonial era slave holders in the Caribbean especially. So it worked in that it was an effective way to mobilize political consensus to abolish an abhorrent practice, but it was very costly. Still, less costly, I would argue, than the abolition of slavery in the country I come from the United States, where slaveholders were highly resistant to the idea of abolition, so much so that it required a hugely costly civil war to end the practice. And so I think as we look at this transition we're facing now, those are the kinds of politics we need to have in our mind. Not today, maybe, but as this transition proceeds, whole swaths of the economy are going to have to change or go away. And that's true for coastal property owners as well as for oil and gas companies. You know, we can only have ExxonMobil or Miami Beach. We can't have both. We have to make a choice there. And how that choice gets made, I hope, will be done through a more patient, deliberative, justice-seeking political process than the history of slavery and its abolition suggests.
But what you've said there, Tom, suggests that it's not going to be ordinary market forces at work doing the business.
So I think ordinary market forces indeed will not be doing the work by themselves. This is a social change that is required, a political choice that we're making to drive the economy toward an outcome we all, I think, want. Leaving the free market to do as it does currently would be a mistake, given that end. But by the same token, we need those incentives, I would say, in the economic system, in the market system, to drive the kinds of innovation and changes at scale and speed to get to where we're going to go. There's not another way to do it from where we stand currently in the time we need to do it. So it's going to require, the question you've given us is, can capitalism be green? Well, I think it not only can it, but it must be, and we have to make it green.
So Tom makes a good point, though I guess I have a slightly different emphasis. I mean, I think there's, you know, the market forces can take us a long way, actually, and this is partly driven by technology and the fact that some of these technologies are just better and are much cheaper. So, you know, if you look at the UK, for example, globally, if you look at the cost of renewable energy, solar, wind, those costs have fallen dramatically even in the last 5 years. And we can talk about, well, some of that, a lot of that was driven at the beginning by government policy and spending on R&D and also the creation of deployment frameworks and so on. But a lot of that innovation is being driven by the fact that these are becoming cheaper, and that can take us quite a lot of the way, I think. However, you end up with these situations where, sure, market forces in large part might get you to the stage where a coal-fired power station or a gas-fired power station in Europe is no longer economic. But there's often going to be somebody who's willing to buy the asset very cheaply off somebody else and then run it even for a bit longer. And we're seeing this, for example, a Czech company called EPH, which has just been buying up very cheaply coal-fired power stations in Europe that incumbent utilities don't think are economic. They feel that they can operate them much because they bought them so cheaply. They feel that they can make a profit on them. They feel like they can lobby governments to get subsidies for them to run for a bit longer. And so that's where I think the policy backstop becomes really important. You know, market forces will get you a large part of the way, but in many examples, you do need policy to just close down these things permanently. Otherwise, they'll reactivate or there'll be somebody who really just doesn't care and sees a quick buck and proceeds with the suboptimal societal decision.
Right. I mean, earlier I was talking to Johan Rockström, and he seemed to have the view that there was, well, I think he used the word silver bullet here, that if you inject into the economic system a price on carbon, something like 50 euros per ton of carbon, then that almost alone would be enough to shift the economic incentives in such a way as to remove the kind of problem you've just mentioned.
I mean, I kind of disagree with a lot of that quite simplistic talk, usually from economists. Put a price on carbon and the problem is solved. I mean, I think, it is a bit more complicated than that.
Can you explain why?
And where and so on. One of the issues is that economists forget about finance, right? And so the nature of the price you're setting is important. If you're a company and an investor, you want to be able to put a price into a spreadsheet and count on it, so you can invest on the back of it. So that's one important thing. It also would seem odd to me to have, you know, say it's a $50 price of carbon, and you have there's a way of reducing carbon for a dollar, and you're giving the person that's reduced that ton of carbon a $49 rent. Mm-hmm. From that activity. So all I'm saying is that a single global price for carbon, which is often what economists will talk about, that isn't it, actually. We need a variety of different mechanisms that are tailored to delivering specific problems and are designed in a way that are bankable and investable. And often economists forget that.
Right. Are they being deluded by the elegance of their economic models into thinking that you just put this thing, this new factor in there, and everything will even out?
Surely not, Peter. Come on. It's never happened in the history of economics.
Thank you, Tom.
Can I bring, because I actually think there's an interesting group that I've been spending a bit more time trying to get to know, actually. And there was a great HBR article written a few years ago by Peter Bakker. And the headline, I think, was Accountants Can Save the World. And I actually really like the idea of enabling and inspiring and amplifying the work of accountants, because I feel like if we can find ways of measuring and managing some of these factors using some of the systems that already exist, some of the people that have skills that could be deployed towards really figuring out how you bridge the economics with the practice, whether it's in finance, with its operations, I feel like the accountants have a really interesting role that they could play. So I believe that there's a special sort of place for us to be supporting and working with the accounting industry on this particular issue.
Is that a matter of when accountants produce their spreadsheets so companies can report to their stakeholders? You actually have things on there to do with the environment as well as to do with profit. Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, and I think, another way of approaching it is to think about the role of accountants to be finding ways to value positive and negative externalities. And that's one of the things that they can do and they should do more of, I think, with sort of some of these issues in mind. But there's also like the rules of the game in the accounting industry. I'm really interested in GAAP. Which are a set of sort of principles that are used in accounting. And there's sort of concepts like going concern, which, as far as I understand it, is about really a company being reviewed by accountants and audited and providing the sort of assurance that it will maintain its operations over the course of a period of time. And I think generally that amount of time is 12 months. However, if that principle or that rule was changed and instead it was over a much longer term horizon, then all of a sudden, I think we might be seeing things emerge differently in how accountants are sort of, again, providing their sort of level of review and assurance on the viability of different businesses.
Is that going to require accountants to be able to see into the future and know what economic or other developments there might be? I mean, it's difficult enough, isn't it, to predict finances 12 months ahead?
Yeah, no, I agree. However, what it would be interesting to do is figure out how to help accountants really think longer term and enable them to have sort of the different tools and practices that will allow them to be sort of advisors and trusted guides for businesses and for investors in those businesses.
Right. And can you say a little bit more about the valuing of positive and negative externalities? So I take it what you mean there is, suppose a company is undertaking some business, and as a side effect of that business, it's generating lots of nasty stuff in the environment.
Yeah.
That's a negative externality.
Yeah.
Right? But you want to put a duty on the company accountants to value those externalities.
Yeah, and I think not just negative externalities, sorry, just to be clear.
Sure,
I think the other side
of
that is positive. So, when you've got a business that is creating positive impact because of how its business is operating, and there's a whole bunch of ways you can frame that up, I think those need to be accounted for as well. I think that's a really interesting role for accountants to consider.
Right, okay. And the incentive there for them to build these up is what? How attracting investors, being seen in a good light by the public and by politicians and so forth?
Accountants, do you mean? Like, yeah. Why would accountants do this?
No, why would companies care about... How are you going to give them an economic incentive to care about what the accountants say?
Okay, well, that's a bigger question. I think there's a lot of people in business that are really waking up quite quickly to the fact that in order to be a company that attracts the best talent, is able to engage customers, they need to be taking into account these positive and negative externalities that are being created by businesses. So I think people are certainly choosing where they want to work based on what the company's purpose is. Like, what are they trying to do that is about beyond just making money? And I think we're seeing more and more consumers making quite conscious decisions about how they're voting with their wallet in terms of what companies they want to support with their custom.
And countries are doing that too. So New Zealand has introduced this idea of a welfare budget. So looking not just at GDP, but at a wider range of indicators for what the country values. And if you think about GDP, it's a pretty limited measure given how much importance you put on it. So if your house burns down and you buy a new house, that's good for GDP, but it's probably not good for you. So these kind of indicators are really important steps. And accounting can really be a powerful tool for getting this balance between positive and negative externalities right.
Yeah. I should just say as well, I think there's a lot of work that's already happening in this. And Ben, I know you're very involved with A4S. You know, I feel like I need to disclose that I am on the sort of advisory committee at the ICAW, which is the Institute for Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. And again, I'm really fired up by, you know, sort of some of the stuff that's happening there about how to engage this industry. But as I say, Ben, you probably have a very, a complimentary view on it based on what the work is that you've been doing with accountants as well.
Ben?
It's critical that these things can be measured, but it's really difficult. How do we measure the positive impacts, negative impacts, the risks? And it's not just at a company level, of course. It's sub-company, it's at the asset level, and then it's how do you aggregate all of that up to the portfolio. If you're looking at the stock market, if you've got a portfolio of shares or a loan book, a portfolio of different loans. And this is very active. And there's a lot of work going on. And we've obviously talked about the accounting profession. There are a couple of initiatives that are trying to accelerate this dramatically. One is on climate-related risks, and the Financial Stability Board created something called the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures to create some standards and some process around how companies should think about climate-related risk and disclose them to their wider stakeholders. There are currently efforts to try and extend that into nature, so looking at nature-related financial risks as well as impacts. And there are also efforts to look at all the different SDGs.
You say there are these various initiatives. How much impact have they had and how global has that been?
Well, I think they have had a lot of impact. I think the TCFD in particular has really encouraged companies to think systematically about these issues. I'm not sure many companies are actually coming up with accurate measures of risk. However, they're at least thinking about it. Now, that's an important development. Whether it's enough, it's clearly not enough to get companies to align with the Paris Agreement and those objectives. So in that context, it's a very minor difference. But it does mean that company directors, boards, thinking about this in a much more serious way, and that does help.
Are there other levers that you think could be pulled or adaptations made to the financial system to encourage faster movement?
Absolutely. And there are lots of levers that can be pulled. I think, you know, on this question of measurement, there are a whole range of new technologies that allow us now to see what's going on in companies without them disclosing anything. And we're just at the beginning of understanding those use cases. A lot of this is about sensors. It's about new Earth observation platforms. It's about new satellite constellations and all that imagery being processed rapidly using artificial intelligence and data science to derive insights. So companies, even if they haven't signed up to these things, or they're not listed companies, a lot of the requirements focus on listed companies, you can actually see what's going on. But financial institutions aren't using these data sets yet in a big way. So that needs to change. And then you have requirements that can be placed on financial institutions. One of the big things that happened this month was that the Bank of England supervisory statement for banks and insurers basically came into force in mid-October. And part of that was that UK regulated banks and insurers had to nominate somebody under something called the senior managers regime to be responsible for climate risk in that institution. And the senior managers regime as kind of interesting because it's set up after the global financial crisis. It basically means that the regulator will know that you're responsible for something even after you leave. So 10 years hence, they will know that Joe Bloggs was responsible for this in this institution. And if it all goes wrong, then you'll be held to account. And that dramatically changes this from being a kind of a nice to have voluntary thing to something where, my God, I might be held accountable. I might be fined or taken to court if we don't have a plan to do this properly.
Do these sorts of things exist more widely internationally? Is Britain leading the world in this?
They will do very quickly. So, you know, the Bank of England first announced its intention to introduce these sorts of things in 2015. They published a consultation on this particular issue in 2018. It came into force this year. There is now a network of central banks and financial supervisors consisting of 46 different central banks and financial supervisors around the world. Given that it took the Bank of England the first 4 years to go from accepting it was in its mandate to actually changing regulation and supervisory practice, there's no reason why it can't happen much, much quicker now in other jurisdictions. So this is one of a very important lever. And it was something that was completely missing from the environmental discourse until very, very recently. So I think that's quite an important development.
Shaw?
Well, I actually have a question I'd like to ask. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to sort of turn the tables a little bit here, but because we're talking about levers, I'm just curious about Ben and Tom, your thoughts on the lever of public activism and movements of people that are really sort of stepping up, it feels, in a new way, whether it's Greta Thunberg or, you know, what's been happening with Extinction Rebellion here in the UK and globally. So I'm just curious about whether or not that's one of the levers that you see having the possibility to have impact.
Absolutely. I think, you know, as I was saying before, we have to make capitalism green, and politics is how we do that. And the movements we see around the world today, which are raising climate change to a level of political science that it never had before, are really exciting because they're showing that this kind of change may indeed be coming much faster than even the most forward-thinking businesses were thinking even a year ago. So I think this is a really positive development. It's by no means guaranteed to succeed, right? This is a political battle now of a kind we've not seen before, but one where at least there's another side waking up.
There are also now efforts to try and empower owners of capital, i.e. us, you know, savers, retail savers, individuals that have pension schemes, to put influence on our banks and our pension schemes. You know, to what extent do any of us in general pay attention to the holdings that exist within our pension schemes? And the answer is the vast majority of people don't know what's in their pension. Perhaps they should. And if they did and were concerned about it, then as they are the ultimate client, that might help to change things quite dramatically. Richard Curtis and others have announced this new campaign that I think is launching in January called Make My Money Matter, that will try and elevate this issue amongst savers and retail investors. And I think that is super important. But it also, I mean, this does, we're getting into, it's not just win-win. I mean, there is a potential backlash here. And I think there is an interesting contrast between the school strikers, and Greta has been very focused on the science. But this is the IPCC's science. This is the action we should be taking. Versus, for example, some of the actors within the Extinction Rebellion who have not been so focused on the science and have been quite happy to actually promote things that are not aligned with what the IPCC says or what the UK Committee on Climate Change will say.
For example,
and I think that's worrying.
Can you give examples of what they've been promoting which isn't in line
with that? Well, the main claim around, you know, if we have 10 years to save the world, those sorts of claims, and there have been kind of rebuttals to that in nature and things like that.
And on this podcast, actually.
Right. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the theme also of activism changing the environment. I mean, you're talking about changing it for companies, but we've talked with Caroline Lucas, for example, in Westminster about how it can change the environment from the point of view of politicians. It can give them an interest.
It's interesting because I should frame, like, I'm not an economist. But one of the frameworks that we find really interesting to play around with a little bit in our circular economy class is around looking at macro and micro economics, but also framing up a conversation around meta-economics and meso-economics. And it's this interesting...
Can you explain what those
are? Yeah, okay. So I'll probably focus on meso-economics because I feel like that's the space that I think there's some magic in. From what I understand, meso-economics is about the formal and informal contracts that we have with one another, with institutions. It's sort of the bridging that exists that allow, big political decisions to be made at sort of a macro level, and then the sort of individual decisions that we might make as individuals or as firms at a more micro level. And so I'm just really interested in what are the sort of levers that can be affected in that meso level, because it changes the sort of, again, the relationships we have and informs the decision making. And that's why, again, it's to me the accountants kind of are in that meso layer, because they're intermediating between different entities. And I'm just going through my own personal sort of thought experiment a little bit about where and how activism and sort of some of these movements that we've just talked about, how they are influential and create change, again, when you look at things from a meso-economic level. But I'm sure there are many more, much more thoughtful and educated economists that can speak to that particular
but
point.
But on that point, do you see shareholder activism as having a big impact? That's a big trend we see these days. I think there's a big considered effort by investors to be more activist on their shareholding. And I think the results have been interesting in some ways, but it'd be hard to say. I can't think of a company that's a big fossil fuel company that's actually decided we're going to be completely different now because of this. Maybe that's too high of a standard to set, but I'd be curious, you think, is that a way forward?
Shareholder activism. I'm not sure how powerful the shareholder activists can be. I'm sort of more interested in how we mobilize stakeholders to help influence decisions that are going to be made for both those who are shareholders in the companies as well as those wider stakeholders that are influences by company decisions. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question properly, but it's partially because I'm really interested in that wider conversation where we move beyond just prioritizing what's needed for shareholders, and instead we look at a wider view of what are the stakeholder requirements and needs.
But there may be a very different issue, I guess, for different companies. I mean, if you're a fossil fuel company, then you're facing some pretty fundamental change. It's not something that can just be tweaked. Let's do the things in one way rather than another because it's maybe marginally more costly, but we've got shareholders who are pushing us in that direction. I mean, with fossil fuel companies, it's far more radical. I mean, how do you address that, Tom?
Well, there's the Danish oil and natural gas company, or I may be getting the title wrong, it was a fossil fuel company, and now it's a renewable energy company. DSM, which is a big global maker of pharmaceutical products and food and other things, used to be, if I'm not mistaken, a coal mining company. So these transitions do happen sometimes. It's true that the biggest companies that make their money not by selling or distributing energy, but by digging it out of the ground, none of those, I don't think, have quite embarked on this transition to the extent they need to. But some are now hedging their bets in a much more proactive way than they were even a few years ago. So I think there is some change there.
And going back to our earlier conversation with Ben, maybe governments need to incentivize them and compensate them a bit for their stranded assets of coal mines that are now useless. So whatever. Yeah.
It's just cool. We use Royal DSM as one of our, case studies that we spend a bit of time talking about because of exactly that. They're a living case example of a company that has gone through a transition through different markets and is still, it's been able to figure out how to do that internally, how to, reframe what it does from a business model perspective and kind of come out on the other side. So I think there's a lot of really interesting lessons to learn from DSM and their leadership team on how to manage a transition.
Ben, is there anything you'd like to add on this?
There's been a big debate about the role of divestment versus engagement or shareholder engagement and the shareholder activism we were just talking about. And a lot of campaigners saying, look, it's just unacceptable to own any of these companies and they're not going to change. And I think for some of these companies, as discussed, it's very, very hard to imagine them making some of these structural changes. And particularly, they're not going to make these structural changes as a result of the odd shareholder resolution. You might be able, through shareholder engagement, to to get companies that are making regular choices and have options to change, to actually change. So, for example, automobile companies or power companies, they're making decisions about what new products to make and R&D investments to make, and also what kind of power to dispatch. And so the kind of inherently marginal instrument like shareholder engagement of the kind that currently happens anyway, could be quite effective and seems to be quite effective for those sectors. But I think we also need to think more carefully about how we use the financial system to change company behavior. And it's not just shareholder resolutions. It's not just the kind of traditional shareholder engagement we've seen, which is, again, mainly focused on, in the US and in Europe in particular. It's that kind of model. It's not just shareholders. It's also bondholders. Banks in the vast majority of markets are incredibly influential. In most markets, there are 2, 3, 4 large banks. And if you're a company and you have a credit facility with a bank and they go, look, you need to improve your environmental performance, otherwise we're not going to extend your credit facility, or we're going to increase your cost of capital, you're much more likely to respond to that. So it's a sort of, I think it's a, the targets of engagement, what are you trying to achieve? And then what are all the levers that need to be pulled together to achieve that? And so I think that we'll see investor activism or financial institution activism and engagement becoming, I hope, and it seems to happen, becoming much more sophisticated and looking across different assets. They're becoming more campaign-y and a bit more joined up. And in that way, it could become more effective.
Right. Thank you very much.
Can I just say, because to me, that's a really interesting way of thinking about some of the conversation we had earlier about a movement of movements, because in some ways you can have all these different levers, and if different people have their hands on levers at different times, pulling at different moments, we're never going to really kind of drive the level of change that's needed. So the idea of, again, the coordinated approach of identifying what is the lever that a group would agree needs to be pulled and getting everyone's hand on that lever pulling at the same time, that's, I think, one of the ways we're really going to see change happen.
Okay. You would agree with that, Tom?
Very much so. I think we need to have a cross-sectoral approach. We need to have this kind of political momentum that's going to guide the invisible hand in the right direction. And joining those two together will be the only way we can achieve this transition. We need to achieve at the scale and speed we need to achieve it.
Yeah. Is that a note of unanimity, Ben?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we're all in agreement on this point.
Thank you very much. That's a very nice point on which to end our discussion. But just to sum up, I'd be very interested to know how optimistic or pessimistic you each feel and what particular points inspire that optimism or pessimism. Tom.
Thank you, Peter, for having us for this conversation. Thank you, Ben and Shar, for giving me a bit more optimism, actually, I think, than I had before. I'm an optimist by disposition, but we have to remember that in the realm of climate change, we're kind of in the realm of having achieved 1 degree of climate change and really trying to limit that to another half a degree or at most 1 more degree. And so our optimism has to be qualified in that we're limiting damage as opposed to bringing things forward. But I think if we actually get this right, if we figure out how to make the economy point in the direction we want it to point, we're going to create a lot of other benefits beyond stopping climate change. And that might be a source of greater optimism going forward.
Thank you very much. Shah.
Well, thank you. This has been such a fascinating way to spend an afternoon. And I'd agree with Tom. I feel like I've learned a lot and I'm feeling ever more hopeful having had a chance to have this kind of conversation. So I learned a word a couple of years ago that has really inspired me, actually. And that word is heliotropy. And it actually comes from concept in botany, which is to describe the tendency of plants to grow in the direction of the sun. And I like that, actually, because I can imagine a sort of field of sunflowers. And as the sun crosses over the horizon, the blossoms of those sunflowers sort of follow it across the sky. And I think we as humans are not that different than our cousins in the flora community. I think we will grow taller and stronger and faster with the speed and the scale that's needed when we're motivated by things that are full of warmth and light and positivity. However, I would sort of agree with what Tom said. I mean, we are in a very, very difficult position, I think, when it comes to climate. So we can't be like ostriches with our heads in the sand and ignoring the conditions that we are operating in right now and the urgency to act. So I think let's be optimistic and heliotropic, but make sure that heliotropy is grounded in the reality and is backed sort of with the evidence that exists that needs to sort of spur us forward. And so to answer your very sort of pointed question, Peter, I think, you know, what gives me a lot of hope is what I am seeing and feeling and experiencing in the global B Corp community. And B Corps, for those who aren't familiar, are for-profit businesses that operate at the highest standard in terms of how they do their business and also what their business model is. So those positive externalities that are created. They've also gone through a process of legally in their, you know, governing documents, making it explicit that they run and operate for the benefit of both shareholders and stakeholders. And so those two groups are treated equally.
Stakeholders here meaning?
It means workers, customers, local communities, you know, future generations by way of how that business is considering the environmental impacts of how it operates. So again, it's a very, very high standard in terms of how a business runs and what it's designed to do, where that focus is enshrined in its sort of constitution. And I think the reason why I want to just reference B Corps as being a real sense of hope is that, you know, there's over 3,000 of them now around the world. Some of them are names you'd recognize and not be surprised by, companies like Patagonia. Some of them are smaller businesses working in the B2B space. So it's a really incredibly diverse community. And I think what we've been excited to see over the last little while is just how many of them are really stepping up to what we're seeing in the climate space. And so we're really excited because there's going to be an opportunity for a group of these B Corps who are willing to make a very ambitious commitment in terms of how they want to tackle climate. And we're looking at net zero targets by 2030. So we're going to try and find ways to elevate and lift up some of these B Corps that are really sort of stepping up to this. And we also, earlier on this year, put together a playbook on how B Corps, but actually all businesses, can declare a climate emergency. So we've seen, you know, UK Parliament declare a climate emergency. We've seen universities. We've seen institutions and institutes like REBA for those architectural professionals. And so the question is, what does declaring a climate emergency look like for businesses? And we're really excited to see that there's a lot of businesses that are really recognizing that there's big change that's needed and are interested in being on a journey of really stepping up.
And you think these 3,000 can inspire thousands more around the world?
Absolutely. To move in the same direction. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, okay, that's a nice note of optimism. Thank you very much. Ben, how do you see things?
Well, thank you, Peter. It's been a really interesting discussion. So I'm very much a tech optimist. I mean that in terms of both the technologies required to become sustainable, but also in sort of societal tech, you know, the ways that we as societies can organize new ways of cooperating, collaborating to achieve environmental outcomes. I'm very optimistic about all of those things. And I think we will have those technologies in place to become truly environmentally sustainable. But I just don't think, given the lack of time, that we'll be able to do this before we breach many of these ecological thresholds. Now, the question will be whether some of these are irreversible or not, and how we can bring ourselves back from the brink around the world, and when we can do that by. So sort of optimism tempered by, I fear, some reality. But narrowing down on finance, I'm very confident that we can green the financial system very quickly. We can measure these things, and we'll be able to, you know, that'll happen very quickly, given some of these new developments in technology that I mentioned, that we'll be able to use finance to engage with companies and governments to make sure that they're much more sustainable and do that much more clever way and effective way. But of course, finance, like politics, like technology, you know, these are all necessary conditions. They're not sufficient conditions. What I'm hoping is that next year in the UK, and I'm hoping that Oxford also plays a very big role with COP26 in Glasgow, that we can make some progress in crystallizing ambition in all of these areas. In the patch that I follow the closest, obviously finance, the UK government has a systemically important role for the global financial system. London is the most international global financial center. Practices developed here, regulations developed here will get very quickly adopted elsewhere. So we can move very quickly as the UK in that area, but we can also contribute across all these other areas. So an exciting time, but we need to speed up.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, and thank you, Tom and Shah.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
Earlier, I took the opportunity for a chat by Skype to Professor Johan Rockström, Vice Chair of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. The call cut out in a few places and the recording isn't brilliant, but he made some very interesting points that are relevant to this debate. Johan, really nice to have you here on Future Makers. You were once named Swede of the Year for your engaging and exciting work in sustainable development. Can you briefly summarise the focus of your work over the last few years?
My kind of previous position was as a professor in global sustainability science at Stockholm University and starting the Stockholm Resilience Centre, which we did 2007. So that's over, well, it's 12 years ago. And during this, let's say, this decade of scientific advancement, my own, academic career has focused very much on the advancements of planetary stewardship, or what we can call how can humanity secure a future where we maintain the stability and resilience of our planet, of the entire Earth system, and really focusing in on the interactions between different, what I call planetary boundary systems and processes that regulates the state of the Earth system. So recognizing, for example, that our only chance to really succeed in delivering on the Paris Climate Agreement, to have a future for all communities in the world, for the world economy at large to stay well below 2 degrees Celsius and aiming for 1.5, will require nothing less than a sustainability transformation within a safe operating space on Earth that requires that we stay within scientific targets, not only for carbon and fossil fuels, but also for biodiversity and land and water and nitrogen and phosphorus and air pollutants, in order to have a chance to really, really maintain the stability of the planet. And when this was first launched together with colleagues around the world in 2009, it was perceived almost like a scientific provocation in the beginning, and it was to challenge my dear fellow scientists around the world. Today, 10 years later, it is a well-established scientific discourse. And one proof of that, for example, is that already in 2009, among the planetary boundaries that we've been exploring, we defined the climate boundary. Of course, that's one of the boundaries regulating the state of the Earth system at roughly 1.5 degrees Celsius. And it took almost 10 years later that the international climate science community through the IPCC also confirmed that 1.5 degrees Celsius is not a socioeconomic choice. It's not like a temperature number that we choose because that's as far as we can go socially. Oh no, this is a hardwired boundary number that if you go beyond it, we risk triggering different feedback dynamics in the Earth system that could actually propel us into, you know, much more heightened temperatures than we had expected. So that's my line of research.
Can I ask you a little bit more about planetary boundaries? Because you've mentioned there particularly the climate, the temperature threshold. But planetary boundaries, you've got 9 of them altogether, right?
Yes.
And do these interact intimately together, or can they be treated as relatively separate?
No, they interact intimately, and they are hardwired and interconnected in the Earth system. So that is one of the major contributions with the planetary boundary framework, that the question posed when we identify and advance the quantifications on planetary boundaries is, what are the processes that regulate the state of the planet? And that's where the 9 systems have emerged, with the scientific proof that if we take them just very rapidly, I mean, there are three of them that operate at the planetary scale. They're perfectly mixed. They operate. We have the climate system, the stratospheric ozone layer, and the ocean dynamics of the functioning in the oceans, how they regulate water flows and nutrient flows and energy and heat in particular. So these are the three big ones. But then you have four boundaries that are the biosphere boundaries, the slow variables that do not have scientific evidence of planetary scale tipping points, but they regulate the functioning and the resilience of the whole system, like under the hood of the planetary biophysical machinery. And these are biodiversity, land systems, nitrogen and phosphorus flows, so the biogeochemical flows, and the global hydrological cycle, the very bloodstream of the whole Earth system. So without water flows, you don't have biomass, and thereby you don't have carbon sinks. And then, of course, you have a completely different state of the planet. Then you have the two last ones are what we could call the aliens, which are, you know, they don't have anything to do with the natural Earth system. They're created by us humans. They are artificial in that sense. And one of them is what we today call novel entities, which is all the chemical pollutants from nuclear waste to microplastics to persistent organic pollutants and endocrine disruptors. So everything that we're loading into the planet, which is completely artificial and that will load and interacts that could potentially impact on genetic composition of species, for example. And then finally, what we call the aerosol loading boundary, which is air pollutants that we are loading so much particles in the atmosphere that could shade the planet, for example. When you look at these nine together, we have today quite a high degree of confidence that you get it right on these nine, they are the ones that determine the state of the planet. So there's not a tenth, but there's not either eight of them. It seems like we've got the nine quite right.
With the 1.5 degrees, you, as it were, anticipated by quite some distance what is now a consensus. Mm. With regard to the other eight, are other people following there as well?
Well, the jury is still out, I would argue. I mean, your first question was, do these intimately interact? And the answer is yes. So, for example, we have some work going on right now showing that if we transgress the biosphere boundaries on land, water, biodiversity, nitrogen, phosphorus flows, we have no chance of keeping the climate boundary at 1.5. In fact, we can show today that the biosphere boundaries themselves have been absorbing so much greenhouse gases that if they had not done it, we would have already now have passed 1.5 and been, you know, on our way, I mean, really decisively on our way towards 2 degrees Celsius warming. So it's just proof that the boundaries, the four boundaries in the biosphere, the biodiversity, land, water, nitrogen, phosphorus boundaries, control and keep the resilience and the climate boundary at bay, so to say. Now, do those numbers, are those numbers, so to say, predefined and that we're moving in that direction? I would argue that, yes, on biodiversity, for example, we already in 2009 stated that we're deep in the red on loss of biodiversity. We put it at quantitative levels of maximum allowed extinction rates of species. There's no consensus around those numbers yet, but they are increasingly discussed very prominently in the scientific community. And as you may know, next year, 2020, there will be the big UN meeting on biodiversity in Kunming in China at the end of the year to define the next scientific targets for policy on biodiversity. And there are discussions right now on trying to, you know, develop an apex target for biodiversity, a planetary boundary for biodiversity. And who knows, that this might be a time when the planetary boundary research can contribute towards the basis for that work.
You've done quite a lot of advising to governments and business networks and so on all these matters. I can imagine that you may get quite a lot of pushback, but have you found this a largely hopeful or a frustrating process?
No, it's been a very hopeful process. I mean, sure, there is a back and forth, and there's, of course, a very healthy and important scientific debate that is continuously ongoing, not least when it comes to the sensitive area of quantifying boundaries for different processes in nature and in the function of the Earth system. But what's hopeful and really encouraging is that we see a very significant trend over the last 5 years in particular, that businesses and cities around the world and nations actually, but particularly businesses and cities, are really interested in getting science-based targets, as they are called, so planetary boundaries that go beyond climate to set the boundary conditions or the guardrails or the targets for businesses in their investments and in their entrepreneurial ventures. And that this started actually with the climate initiative in Paris. So when the world gathered in Paris in 2015, the so-called science-based target initiative was born, which was to translate the well below 2 degrees Celsius boundary into quantitative numbers, carbon budgets that could be used in business. And this has been led by the World Resource Institute together with a whole series of institutions around the world, very significant, coordinated by We Mean Business. Over 700 companies in the world actually have adopted science-based targets for carbon. And now we are at a point of taking the next step of bringing in the planetary boundaries for these science-based targets in a science-based targets for the Earth system initiative, which is under the umbrella of a partnership that we call the Global Carbon and the Global Commons Alliance. And here you have the business partnership, the policy partnership, and science. So that's quite exciting how there is a movement here in the business sector in particular to try and adopt planetary boundaries in their work.
You've mentioned there the businesses that are going along with it. Presumably, there's an awful lot more to be done. How influential is it, do you think, more widely?
Well, of course, one would have wished, let's say, that it would have been more widely adopted, because science today is very clear that for world development at any scale, if you want to have good economic development in a country or in a community or in a region of the world, we need now to recognize that we're putting pressures on the entire planet. We are in the Anthropocene, as the new geological epoch is defined. We're the dominant drivers of change at the planetary scale. So, of course, something like planetary boundaries is required to guide and navigate this globalized phase of pressures on the planet. So in that context, there's reason to be very concerned that, we're talking of a handful of countries that have started to consider planetary boundaries in their policy making. And some of them are, for example, the Netherlands and Switzerland, and right now, as we speak, New Zealand, but also some of the Nordics. But of course, that's very few countries in a world with 195 countries. So I would argue that we are so far failing on a scientifically aligned pathway towards sustainable development, where we recognize what science is saying, namely that we now have to take care of the entire planet within safe operating space or planetary boundaries. On the other hand, we see promising movements in the right direction. So it's this dichotomy. And of course, if you force me to put a weight on this dichotomy, I would today, unfortunately, conclude that there's more reason for concern than hope. And the reason for that is that we're running out of time.
Yes, exactly. That time is crucial, isn't it? You can't wait for movements to build from the bottom up, perhaps. Don't you need to get governments involved and get them actually imposing targets rather than relying on a relatively small number of businesses who are positively inspired in this direction?
No, I agree with you here. This is, we have to move bottom up, but also top down, and accelerate through regulatory measures from above. And the governments have to come on board. I think we should never give up on the United Nations and the General Assembly and the ability to get consensus around some of these, compulsory targets that nations need to stay within. And that's quite frankly where we are so far not succeeding. But you're absolutely right. We cannot. I mean, I think the value of these initiatives from cities and communities and businesses is that they put on the political system, but they also create confidence by showing that transitions into more sustainable futures where you decarbonize or adopt planetary boundaries in different cases can actually be a quite successful route also for the economy. And that, of course, is an engine for political support. But again, it's moving too slowly.
Yeah. So they can provide exemplars and say, look, yes. Yeah, we can do it. Therefore, others could do it too. And you governments ought to stop thinking that this is impossible.
Exactly. I mean, that's why, for example, right now, as we speak, in my new position here as the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany, we have a very constructive dialogue with the incoming new presidency of the European Commission, Ulrika von der Leyen, and her team, and Frans Timmermans, the new climate commissioner. The European Union, I would argue, is has been for quite some time and must continue to be like the world leading region on the transition to a zero carbon future within planetary boundaries. And that this is more than just a nation example. This would be the world's largest economic region, proving to the world that we can create really good lives for citizens, good competitive economic development within planetary boundaries. I mean, that's the big, holy grail of success. And I think this is what we now need to aim for, to find these alliances and regions and groups and sectors that are willing to really put this to the test and scale and to show to other parts of the world that, yes, this makes sense.
Right. I mean, presumably there are quite a lot around the world who are going to say this kind of thing isn't really compatible with the way that modern economies work. I mean, the idea, for example, of top-down dictation of what should happen. There are some prominent actors in the world who are going to say this is just anathema. Do you feel that the sorts of moves that you're looking for are compatible with the way that economic systems work around the world?
Well, not in the way economic systems tend to work as we see it today. On the other hand, I would like to say that we don't have to fundamentally throw out the current economic system and put in place a completely new one to succeed. It's quite important to remember that we are quite effective in putting top-down regulatory decisions when it comes to financial transactions, when it comes to trade, when it comes to military operations, when it comes to just look at what is happening now when it comes to Syria and the whole Middle East sensitivity, how the world actually can kind of gather together and take this as a global concern. And we should be able to do exactly the same thing when it comes to climate. And remember that take the following. I mean, there's so much economic research showing that there is almost like a silver bullet to succeed on the climate planetary boundary, which is to impose a price on carbon, because that's fundamental economics, that you price an externality, which is a market failure, that we destroy our climate by emitting greenhouse gases. You internalize that externality, you put a price. We know that the price should be somewhere between 50 and 100 euros per ton of carbon dioxide. If you put it at 50, most research shows that that would be enough as an incentive for financial institutions and the economy at large to stop all forms of investments in fossil fuels, in infrastructure. And that would, basically overnight give you a path forward. Now, many have argued that, well, that's utopia. We cannot do a global price on carbon. Well, you don't need to do it globally. You can agree in principle globally, but you can have local or regional adaptations, just like the European trading scheme on carbon. And remember that we have roughly 50 countries in the world that have adopted a price on carbon, not necessarily a high enough price, but there is a policy measure with a price on carbon. The European Union has its emission trading scheme. And that just shows that almost 25% of the nations in the world have priced carbon, and that we could see an evolution towards a price on carbon in all economic regions in the world. And I know the following is often criticized, but I think that it's time, for example, for the European Union to say not only are we raising our own carbon price with a floor price of, let's say, at least 30, preferably 50 euros per ton of carbon dioxide, we can also impose an import tax on all imported goods into the European Union, which would then even out the market failures of importing goods that have been produced without a carbon tax. And that would, of course, put a lot of pressure in the global system.
You're talking here about preserving our current economic framework, but putting a price on carbon and thus harnessing the incentives that are already implicit within that framework.
Yes, that's right. And that internalizing that externality would be the most conventional, simple, effective route towards creating the incentives required on the climate boundary. And I think similar strategies can be applied also for the other boundaries.
So how would you do that for some of the others then? Can you give some illustrations?
Well, one example would be on the land boundary. If you put the right type of internalizing externalities on stores of carbon or biodiversity and natural ecosystems, you would then create a value which would enable you to avoid situations where it becomes, as it is today, worth destroying natural forests for the sake of expanding agriculture. Now, agriculture is not a high capital value in its fundamental production step. So if you put a higher value on the natural ecosystems, you could quite quickly turn the logic around economically on where is your highest profit making venture.
Thank you. So would you say you're generally optimistic in that you'll be able to carry other people along with these ideas? I mean, you mentioned that there's a major meeting next year. How do you see things going towards that? Is there a lot of consensus amongst those who will be contributing?
I mean, I would argue that there is a very significant trend towards recognizing planetary boundaries and the risks of planetary stability due to all the negative pressures we're posing, again, not only on climate, but also on particularly biodiversity. So I think that recognition is rising. I think there's also a rising sense that sustainability is no longer this old environmental agenda of protecting nature and that we're sacrificing ourselves to do that, but rather that sustainability can be the entry point towards innovation and transformation, technologies and different kind of designs of systems. That is a modern future agenda. I think that is also a very significant trend line. So yes, I think we're seeing a rising enthusiasm and engagement on the planetary boundary and global sustainability agenda. Again, is it happening fast enough? So far, no. Can we see the momentum next year? We know that next year is the year that essentially all scientific assessments show that we need to start bending the curve of change, that this is something that that is really, really important. I'm sorry to say that my phone is calling it because I need to head off into Berlin, unfortunately.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Johan. That's been a very interesting conversation. I do hope very much that you succeed in getting these ideas broadly accepted and influential.
Thanks very much, and I appreciate this discussion.
My thanks again to our panel, Ben, Charmaine and Thomas, and also to Johan, and thank you very much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, I hope you'll leave us a rating and a review, and I do hope you'll join me next time as we discuss whether we can or should take anyone to court for climate change.